Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to the Folklore Podcast. I'm Mark Norman, folklore researcher and author. Thanks to everyone who's been commenting on all of the content that we've put out recently. I'm glad that you're all enjoying the episodes. There's going to be some exciting news soon about a new live interactive development from the Folklore Podcast. Please make sure that you follow our Facebook page or Twitter feed to hear about that as soon as we release the news. There has been more additional content added to the Patreon feed recently, with more coming soon, as well as some advanced notice of other developments which will be released there first. You can sign up from as little as $1 a month, and not only ensure that you get access to all of the exclusive content at your support level, but also know that you are helping to keep the Folklore Podcast both viable and commercial free. I am still turning down offers of advertising on the podcast because you tell me that you prefer the show without it, and it is the support on Patreon which allows me to do this. Patreon support is also directly allowing the development of the new project which I'll be announcing soon. Thanks to everyone who supports the podcast. If you are familiar with the term väsen and you aren't from Sweden, then it is likely that you became aware of the term through the American drama series Grimm. This fantasy show suggested that many of the people with whom we share our lives may not be human at all, but may secretly be able to transform into a range of folkloric creatures or monsters, which the show calls väsen. Väsen is, in fact, a Swedish term for a range of folkloric creatures. Joining me on this episode of the podcast to discuss his research into them is Swedish illustrator and author Johan Egerkrans. His book, Väsen, published in 2019, is a wonderful bestiary of the spirits and monsters of Scandinavian folklore, and is soon being released as a role-playing game as well. I chatted with Johan recently about both of these things. Hello everyone, and welcome to the Folklore Podcast and to a new experiment for us. So if you are a Patreon supporter of the podcast, then I'm hoping, if all of this has gone according to plan and technology does not fail us, that you will be able to see us as well as listening to us. If you're listening on the normal podcast feed, of course, then hello, here we are in the world of audio. And joining me on the Folklore Podcast today is Swedish illustrator Johan Egerkrans, who's going to talk a little bit about his work with folklore and illustration. We're going to focus particularly on one of his bodies of work, that of Väsen, and I shall come to that in a moment. But first, Johan, could you just tell us a little bit about your background and how you came to be illustrating all of this lovely Swedish and other folklore?
Certainly. Hello, I'm Johan. Well, I and thanks for having me on the show, I should say. I've been illustrating for all my life. This sounds like the bio on the homepage for my publisher. But I've been sort of drawing all my life. And at an early age, I discovered role-playing games, of which we'll get back to those in a while, I think.
Indeed.
Indeed, as a child, I was really into mythology and folklore and all that stuff, and that just became that was just fueled further by the role playing games, because you had elves and goblins and all that stuff popping up. And in the Swedish role playing games I played, they used the Swedish terms for, instead of goblins, there were vättar and so on. So you had a sort of folkloric aspect to it. So I became a bit interested in where those creatures came from originally. And when I was about 15 or 16, I started working professionally as an illustrator, doing a comic for a local newspaper. And then it sort of snowballed from there. And I met some guys who did a role-playing game called Gemini, and we published that in, what was it? I was like 19 or 20, I think. So that was in early 2000s, late 1999, I think, or 1998. And then from that on, I've been working as a concept illustrator. So I worked as a concept illustrator for computer games. And after a while, that went bankrupt, as computer games companies I want to do. And I became a freelance illustrator. So I did a lot of freelance work for children's books and all that kind of stuff. And after a while, my publisher wanted me to write my own book. And she sort of pushed me. I think she had imagined that I'd do some sort of, something along the lines of Harry Potter or something like that, because that was the rage back then. It's still the rage, but even more back then. And I felt that I didn't want to do another sort of crappy or semi-crappy fictional book based on I Want to Be, connotation, but I mean, a Me Too product based on that sort of initial wave of young adult stuff. I wanted to do something else. And one of my favorite books has always been Fairies by Brian Froud and Alan Lee. And we started talking about that one. And about the same time, the Spiderwick books had been out for a while, but they released the Bestiary. They did like a really nice illustrated encyclopedia of all the fairy tale creatures, very much inspired by fairies as well. I mean, Tony Ditlitz is obviously very inspired by Brian Froud and Alan Lee's work, as am I. So we started thinking about that, and what if we did that in like a Swedish context, just sort of ported it to Swedish and did it in my style and did it in a Nordic style, because that really hadn't been done. And obviously building a lot on the visuals of Jon Bauer, the famous Swedish folklore and troll illustrator, so to speak. So it's just a huge amount of influences that came together, and that became my first. So that was the first book I wrote and illustrated myself. So up until that point, I only illustrated stuff for other people. But that's when I became a writer, so to speak. And we released it, and it went rather well. So then I started doing stuff in that vein. So from then on, I've been doing my own sort of special blend of, I don't know, it's sort of nicely illustrated pop science books, basically.
I think Brian Froud's influence, certainly, and those others, does show through in your work as well. You also have a very, very distinctive style, which I think lends itself really well to this genre. I have got a couple of your books in front of me, one of which is The Undead, which is a really interesting collection of different folkloric creatures from all over the world, I guess, as well. How long do you spend researching before you decide on how to illustrate any of these creatures?
Each book takes about 2 years to do. In the case of Norse Gods, I think it took me 3 years because I had I just couldn't. I had such a, what's it called? I just felt such a pressure to get it right, and it was the big, you know, the hard second album, you know. All, yes. If Lassen is my sort of first initial punk album, punk rock album, and then the Norse Gods book is the pretentious concept album. Pretentious concept prog rock album. No, they take about 2 years. Usually I do research for half a year, then I start sketching and doing whatever pops into my head for a while. And then I at the same time I do the other stuff as well. So it's not like I work full time with one of these books. And then when it's about half a year left until the deadline, I try to keep my deadlines. I push them back sometimes, but I'm not like Douglas Adams. I love deadlines. I love the whooshing noise they make as they go by. I try to refrain from that. But once I start getting close to the deadline, I start. I have to write it. I don't like to write, but then I sort of get cracking and write the whole thing. And at that point, I got perhaps 30% of the illustrations done. But at that point, I've laid the groundwork for the style of the book and the feel for the book. So then it's quite easy for me to just sort of bash out the final 70% of the illustrations. That process can be rather quick, actually. I think I did all the illustrations for The Undead in like 4 months or something, or 3 months. Once I get going, I work pretty quickly. But I need to sort of, and it needs to marinate for 2 years or something like that before I can get cracking.
Yes, and once you've done that research, I suppose then you as you're doing the research and the writing, you're building up a fairly good kind of visual image in your head as to how you want to lay things out, I suppose. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It becomes more and more. I just know how to do it, and once I know that, it's much easier. But you need that sort of you need to ponder it for a bit before it sort of. And then it's quite easy, and especially then when you have to do it, I need a short amount of time to get stuff done, because then I just do it and really effective. But until that point, I'm not very effective. I think perhaps that some people may recognize that.
Yes, I'm sure. Now today, I'd like to concentrate on Vesen. Which I think you described as your punk album, if you're going to use the analogy of albums against books. Can you just explain a little bit about the Scandinavian folklore that make up Vesen and what Vesen are for those that don't know the term?
Well, Vesen is a Swedish word that's roughly translated would be being in English.
Yeah.
So it's got several connotations, but we usually use it for something, a creature, usually with a sort of intelligence, not necessarily, but it's similar to creature, but it's got this more sort of a spiritual part, sort of a spiritual thing to it. I think it and we always use it for this sort of fairy tale or folkloric type of creatures. We use the word Vesen, and the thing with Vesen, the word, it's quite poetic as well, as because Vesen also means essence in Swedish. So you can talk about a thing's Vesen is its essence, you know, the core of the poodle, so to speak.
Yes.
So it's got that sort of Yeah, it's a really multifaceted word, and it's got lots of different sort of connotations. So it's a really nice word. But basically, it means being, and we use that to, as a collective noun for. If you talk about the spirit or something like that, you always call it Väsen, but it's got a sort of air of mystery to it that I.
Yeah, and I think you say, don't you, in the introduction to the book, that these are the kinds of creatures that legend tells us live amongst us, but only make themselves known to us if they choose to do so. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, in that respect, I mean, they're very similar to all folkloric beings in all cultures. I mean, there's nothing that really sets them apart from English folkloric beings or German for other Germanic folkloric beings. They're quite similar. It's just our word for them. In a way, it's similar to, it's a sort of catch-all phrase, in the same as in Japan they talk about yokai.
Yes.
I'm probably mangling the pronunciation of that one, but yokai, I mean, that could be a ghost, or that could be a monster, or that could be anything. And I think Väsen is really a similar term to yokai, I think. But they are quite similar to other folkloric beings. I mean, there's not that a huge difference between a Swedish tomte and a brownie or something like that, or a bäckahäst to a kelpie. But it's a basic concepts pop up all over Europe and all over the world as well.
There are lots of them, aren't there, that have very, very similar roots. I mean, just scanning through the contents of the book, for example, which you divide up into nature spirits and familiars, shapeshifters, ghosts and monsters, for example. There are lots of things here that really would be very familiar to a lot of people. So you talk through fairies and gnomes, for example, trolls, mermaids, werewolves, revenants, these sorts of things. But there are others, aren't there, that are more peculiar to Sweden. Can you pick any out that are particularly Swedish examples?
Well, I think one of the most classic ones, of course, is the tomte, the classic Swedish or Norse tomte or nisse or what have you, which is a sort of caretaker spirit for a farm, the farm gnome.
Yes.
Which incidentally lent its name to the Swedish version of Santa Claus, which is always a bit confusing because it's called the tomte, but it's a very different sort of character. But these guys, they look like, small, grumpy old men. My version is particularly grumpy. but they were often seen as they have some similarities to ancestral spirits. So some people thought they were the guy who actually built a homestead initially, the founder of the farm, the originator of the farm. He lived on as the tomte and took care of the farmstead for the coming generations. So you really have, but he cared more about the farm than the actual people who was occupying the farm at the particular time. He had as he was sort of an immortal ghost, he had a sort of slightly different view of the time and what was important. So you really had to treat him with a lot of respect, and you had to treat the farm with a lot of respect. So there's a lot of stories about lazy farmhands that get sort of beaten up by the gnome, by the tomte.
Yes, and it's often the case that you have to leave kind of offerings for them, isn't it, as well, those sorts of things. And then they will help you happily, but if you neglect them, then they will turn into a different creature, perhaps.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, not in, I mean, it's not like the what is it? It's the hop that or the brown leather turns into a hob or what?
Yes,
I don't know.
Yeah, depending on the area, hobs or brownies. Yes.
He never turns into another type of creature. He's just, if you treat him well, he'll be nice to you. And I mean, one of my favorite stories is, that's where we have this sort of thing about the Christmas porridge that you leave on the doorstep for the tomte.
Yes.
On Christmas Eve. That's a classic tradition. And some people still do that, actually. But there's a classic tale where the farm people leave the porridge, and you're supposed to have a glob of butter in it, or honey. But in this particular tale, it's butter. And the porridge is so hot, so the butter melts and pools on the other, below the porridge.
Yes.
And the gnome comes up to it and becomes enraged because, what, no butter? Bastards. So he goes out and breaks the neck of the largest, or the best cow in the barn, or whatever you keep cows. And then he comes back and eats the porridge anyway because he's hungry. And I mean, keep in mind, this is a pretty small creature, basically the size of a Smurf or something like that.
So yes,
it's
quite
impressive to wring the neck of a cow. Anyway, then he discovers that the butter has pooled on the bottom of the pot. So he becomes really regretful. Then he sort of takes the dead cow on his back and walks away to the neighbors and leaves the cow there and takes their best cow and sort of brings it back to the farmstead. So it's all nice and well for the people actually has the farm, but for the neighbors, they sort of suffer for it. So it's one of those creatures that call a dragväsen in Swedish, like a pull creature, that they pulled riches to a particular place. And that's sort of a common thing, like a familiar, basically. So that's one of the classic ones. One of my personal favorites is it's a ghost, a revenant of a kind called Night Raven, or Nattram. That's one of my favorite, basically, partly because I really like ravens. It's a ghost that takes the shape of a raven. Attacks people at night, and it's also, I think it was now actually the problem is I forget all this stuff because I do one of these books and it's like writing a paper or something. You write it and then you sort of when you were studying for an exam, you read up on it and you had everything in your head, and then you do the and then they did the exam and everything.
So and then that's it. Yeah.
Falls away. And it's a bit like this with these books that I accumulate all this knowledge and then I sort of pour it out when I write it and then I forget all about it. But anyway, the Night Raven, it was suicides or people of low character that got buried outside the churchyard. So they were buried in non-consecrated ground. And some of them became ravens as ghosts. And they were doomed to try to fly towards Christ's grave every night. So every night they flew eastwards. And then they had to go and hide under the ground. And then they continued that trek. But they never got there. They're a bit like... It's like a perpetual judgment, a bit like Sisyphus or something in Greek mythology. There's something that they have to do perpetually, that and then they can never get, they can never reach their goals. That's a sort of
it's like the ultimate punishment, isn't it? It's quite a common kind of folklore trope, I think. This idea of being given, we've talked about it before. In fact, being given an impossible task to do. As retribution, perhaps, for something bad that you did in life. I mean, you say on the... I've got a particular page of the book is here, The Night Raven. And you say in there as well about them also perhaps being the restless soul of a criminal, for example. So that's somebody who's being judged afterwards for what they did in life. Yeah.
Exactly. But it's quite strange because, I mean, it's not that far to Jerusalem.
No, that's true, but perhaps not in one night.
I mean, a raven could make that trek in a few months, probably. So, I mean,
yes, yeah.
Or weeks. I don't know why they never... But
I suppose it's if they have to return, if they have to do it in one night and then return at the end of the night, then that's what makes it the impossible task, I suppose.
Yeah, perhaps they return to the original, something like that. I mean, yeah. It's not quite clear, but
Another one that strikes me, I think, about of being particularly related to Sweden is the Hälsö.
Yeah, the Glosan.
The Glosan, yes. Now, that's something that I don't think we find necessarily in very many other places.
You have the term razorback as a name for wild boars in Australia, I think. I mean, there's a brilliant movie by, what's it called? The guy who directed Highlander did this wonderful creature feature called Razorback in the early 80s. Yes. And, I mean, that's a big, really evil pig. And the Glosan, the Hälsö, has got that sort of razorback quality. They have bristles on the back that are sharp as knives, basically. So they kill people by running between the legs and they sort of gut them. So that's quite visceral.
Also connected as well to to the year walk, which is a divinatory ritual, isn't it, in Sweden? That I know a folklore colleague of mine, Tommy Kusuela, who works in Uppsala, has done a very extensive study of the year walk, and the Glosan comes up in that as being one of those creatures that try to attack you and put you off your path as you're undertaking the ritual. Is that right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, it's one of them. I think it's generally sort of the main antagonist for the person trying to do the year walk. And yeah, the year walk was a ritual that you did. It differs when you did it. Sometimes it's on New Year's Eve. Sometimes it's on Christmas Day Eve, I think. The time when you did it sort of differs between different but basically you walked around, you should visit a number of churches and walk around them, and then when you reach the and at this when you did this ritual, like you say, supernatural creatures would attack you and try to lead you off your path. But if you did this final trek, you had to walk three times through around one church and then go to another and walk three times around that. And sometimes it's seven churches, sometimes it's five churches, sometimes it all differs a bit. But when you reach the final church, you look through the keyhole of the church, and then you would see the future, you would see the coming year, have some sort of vision of what was coming. And that's a really strange thing. I mean, I don't recognize that from any other.
No, I think that is a particularly Swedish ritual, as far as I know. I don't think I've come across it anywhere else either. But it is a fascinating ritual.
The only thing that reminds me of it is this. I think it's an Irish story that Mike Mignola based a Hellboy story on, when the main protagonist has to carry a ghost, or actually the body of a ghost, to different churchyards, all the churchyards, all the souls on the churchyards sort of scream, "Yeah, we're full, we're full, we're full," but he has to find a resting place for this corpse before sunset or something like that, before the sun comes up, I think, before sunrise, and that's sort of it's got some similar themes as New York, but it's more of a fairy tale.
Yes, maybe very loosely based on it, perhaps. And I suppose when you're talking about films and TV as well, if you're going to consider the Vesen, then I suppose what would come to mind for a lot of people is the American serialized drama Grimm, which obviously drew on drew on the folklore of the Wesen for its characters, but perhaps maybe we should say very loosely based again.
I did name the book Wesen after the show because I felt it was familiar enough to actually, because the first working titles were like Fairy Creatures of the North or something like that. How do you translate Wesen into English? And then we sort of, after a while, we sort of tested different titles, and in the end, we just call it Wesen, because people who are interested in this book will probably have seen The Grimm Show, and then they call them Wesen. So I mean, it probably the title.
Well, the show was very popular, wasn't it? And it ran for five seasons, I think. It ran for a long time, and it was, let's face it, quite entertaining in many ways. But as somebody knows a bit more about the background behind the characters or the monsters of Wesen, what did you think of it?
Well, that's the thing. You always have your own view or vision of what the correct version of a creature is, or a tale is, or a legend is. But the thing is, they're really inconsistent in themselves. So, I mean, it's really easy to slack off a show like Grimm and say, no, that's not what they were like. But the folklore itself is so inconsistent. So there is no proper way. I mean, obviously, what I put forth in Wesen is my view of what I think they were like, or at least my vision of them. But that's just my vision. I mean, I think I portray it in a way that people find plausible, or whatever you think. I mean, it sort of feels right, but to me, and apparently to many people. But that's just an interpretation. Grimm is just like, it's just such a valid interpretation as any. I mean, I like to do a similar thing is another book I made, Norse Gods, about the Norse gods.
Yeah.
I mean, that differs. That's my vision of them. That doesn't mean the Marvel Thor movies are wrong. That's just another interpretation of these stories. I mean, I keep a bit closer to Snorre Sturlason and the Eddas, but it's still the Thor films are a valid interpretation of the mythology because they are inconsistent and we have no idea. We just have the Eddas to go by. They were written several hundred years after people stopped believing in the gods. So, I mean, we have no idea what the actual Vikings or medieval Scandinavians actually believed, or what they believed in Germany back in, because these the gods are quite old. So I mean, the first people who believed in them probably lived in like the 4th or 3rd century or something like that. And, I mean, they're really, I mean, there's everything is open to interpretation, and there's no correct interpretation basically. Sorry, very long-winded discussion, but no, I kind of like Grimm. I think, obviously, my view of what these creatures are often differs from their take on it. And it's the same with Supernatural or any other of these shows. I mean, Grimm owes a lot to the Supernatural, I think.
Yes, yes. And, of course, at the end of the day, all these shows is a bit of light entertainment, isn't it? And you know, I think any representation of folklore in the media in those sorts of ways can ultimately only be a good thing because it keeps people interested in the subject.
Yeah. And then you can look up, basically, like with my role-playing games, when I got interested in this stuff, you got some nuggets of information that makes you sort of curious, and then you start researching for yourself.
Yes, yes, exactly. And that's an area that I'd like for us to finish up with, if we may, is the role-playing game aspect. Now, this is an area that we've started to explore on the podcast, looking at the ways that role-playing games and folklore tie together, because folklore very naturally lends itself to the kind of sphere of role-playing because of the fantasy element, the naturally the creatures, such as in Vesin, for example. And also, I think the other aspect of it is, of course, that role-playing games are all about storytelling, ultimately. You take away the mechanics of rolling dice and those sorts of things, you're left with an extended session of storytelling, which is how all folklore was transmitted and how many legends and other pieces of folklore were ultimately created in the first place. So Vesin has been picked up as a suitable theme for role-playing recently. Free League, I think, over in Sweden, who produce role-playing games, have picked this up. I think they've looked at other franchises as well, haven't they? With sort of very rich for storytelling. I still need to play the Alien game, but that looks very appealing. but tell us a little bit about how Vesin went from this paper format into becoming a role playing game.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, isn't it? Because like I said, I sort of became interested in all this stuff because of role-playing games, and now Vesin in itself becomes a role-playing game. So it's gone full circle in a way. But no, the book came out in 2013, and I think I started having discussions with the guys at Free League just the year after, or 2 years after. So basically, just soon after it came out, we started having discussions about this could be a really cool role-playing game. It could work as a role-playing game. And at the time, they had done some stuff. They had done the first edition of a classic Swedish role-playing game called Mutant. That's sort of a science fiction, post-apocalyptic role-playing game. But we had discussions about doing something. And it really inspired by doing a sort of classic gothic horror role-playing game similar to Chill or Call of Cthulhu.
Yeah.
A lot of, you know, Victorian person with a lantern standing on a graveyard and looking looking at something behind him, sort of kind of thing. With mist, you know. A lot of that stuff. We wanted that, but we thought this sort of Swedish or Norse or Scandinavian folkloric stuff could be an extra spice into that kind of horror game. So it's basically the working title was, there's a Swedish version of Chill called Hock, so we called it Troll Hock. That was really the working that sort of formulated the intention of it. But it's coming out in a few weeks, I think, or a few months. It's coming out this summer, I think. I mean, everything's sort of jumbled up now because of Corona and all that stuff.
Cool.
But like you say, it really lends itself well to role-playing games because I think it will be a really interesting game because we really try to keep the creatures, the Vesin, mysterious. So they're not like, you don't get stats for them. It's not like you're attacked by 2d6 goblins. It's not like that. It's much more eerie and they're much more of a force that you have to appease or fight, but you can attack them in different ways, or you can solve the problem in different ways, and they're not evil as such.
No, I have to say, actually, I have to say, it is a really atmospheric game. So we've been playing it for a little while because a friend of mine over in Germany, who we've worked together on a few podcast-based role-playing things for recently, he supported the project a little while ago, so he has the advanced materials. So he's been running a game for us, not as a recorded project, but just as a little diversion in the evenings to try it out. And it is really, really atmospheric. And the reason that I like it so much as well is because, again, it doesn't rely on the whole mechanics of having to look up rules for doing something magical and rolling a whole bunch of dice and that sort of thing. It's about telling a story, and you develop the story through that kind of gaming environment, and it does work really, really well.
Yeah, it's they have a fantastic mechanics, and Lassen is based on the same. You still, it's a role-playing game, so you need mechanics, but it's based on the same system as Tales from the Loop, the role-playing game they made based on Simon Stollenhag's illustrations, and it's very geared towards storytelling, and the only ones you don't have stats for the enemies or the non-player characters, but it's only the main characters that roll the dice, so it's always you against sort of the world in a very profound way, which differs a bit from most other role-playing games when you can sort of look up if you have the character, you have like the Dungeons and Dragons Guide to Gods and Monsters or whatever it's called, and then you can look up Cthulhu or Thor or whatever, and he's got 300 strength and 50,000 hit points, but then they become it lessens them in a way, and we didn't want that. We wanted to keep them mysterious. I mean, it's just they shouldn't have they should be intangible in a way and mysterious.
Yeah, I think that's what makes it far more successful is just being able to tell and develop a story without having to worry about stopping and looking things up. So what do you think it is about folklore generally?
It also makes them more scary, because if you can't pin something down, then it's much more scary than when you can pin it down. So it's really effective in a horror setting as well.
So what do you think it is about folklore and myth and those sorts of things that make them particularly effective in an environment like fantasy and role-playing, for example?
Well, I mean, I think you answered that question. I mean, it is storytelling. I mean, that's really what it is. It is the new way of sitting around the campfire and sort of... And that's the fun when you read your original folkloric tales, you really can sort of sometimes in Sweden they were really good at in the 1800s and late 1700s and early 1900s they travel around and collected all these stories like inspired by the Brothers Grimm, and you can hear it in the because they really recorded exactly what people were saying. You get the feel that these are stories that have been traded over and over again, and they always add their own little flourishes, and they, you know, add their own little jokes or humorous elements. And it's a very living storytelling in a way. And I mean, that's what you do when you role play. And fantasy is about coming up with new cool stuff and sort of, and also adding on an existing mass of cliches and characters. And it's a bit like Commedia dell'arte or something like that you have these sort of archetypical characters and then you can do new stuff with them.
That's a really interesting point, actually, isn't it? Because that's how folklore and stories tend to change and develop is by, you know, adding to them and changing what you know about them. And that, you know, the oral transmission of storytelling has naturally done that for hundreds and thousands of years. And by using this kind of gaming environment, you are essentially creating, you know, modern versions or alternative versions of those older stories or creatures.
Yeah, yeah. And as usual, with your own, you have the point of view of a person living in 2020, which makes you sort of question the archetypes in a way a person living in 2020 only could. yeah. which is different from how you would view a certain character in the 1800s and in the early 1900s. So you. So
was your involvement in the development of the role-playing game more than just supplying the visuals? Did you also have input into the design of the storytelling angle as well, for example, based off your research?
Yeah, I was involved. I mean, I, as an old role-player, I was really interested in how the product came out, so to speak. So I just, it's not just about providing... providing illustrations. So I read the different drafts and came comments and so on. At the end of the day, I haven't written it. I mean, it's not mine. It's Nils Hintze who's written it, and it's his work, so to speak. But during the whole process, I had a discussion, an open discussion with Free League about stuff. and I had a lot of comments about just trying to tweak it so it sort of it matched my vision of it a bit more, and when something was didn't really sort of went off to in another direction, I tried to at least find some sort of balance between my vision and their vision and so on. So I mean, but I was really, and I think it really worked. I mean, and it also became, they had ideas that I never would have thought of. So I mean, it's become a richer, more interesting world than I could have imagined, I think.
And the whole world itself is very rich and fascinating, and I would encourage people to explore it. So as Johan says, the role-playing game version of Vessen comes out hopefully sometime towards the summer and is definitely worth having a look at. I would really, really encourage people to have a look, because your work, Johan, is obviously visual as an illustrator, and we're talking very much in a kind of audio capacity here. But I would really encourage people to have a look at what you produce, because it is such a rich interpretation of the folklore and really, you know, is deserving of being looked at in more detail. Where should people go online to have a look at some of your work?
They can follow me on Facebooks, Johan Egerkrantz Illustrator. You can put that in the show notes, because indeed, people can probably spell Johan Egerkrantz. And then I got a blog as well that I rarely update. I'm on Instagram, Johan Egerkrantz Illustrator as well. For the books, if you live in Sweden, you can buy all the books here, because they are mostly Swedish books. But they've been translated into a lot of languages. They're coming out in Germany now. We have WoW Books are publishing them. And they're out in Denmark and Finland and so on. And my major three books have been... They're Swedish versions, but they are translated into English. So you can buy them in English from Grimfrost, which is an online purveyor of sort of Viking-themed stuff, but they also sell my books. So there you can order them all over the world. So wherever you live, you can order them from them. So that's grimfrost.com.
Fantastic. I will put links on the Folklore Podcast website and in the show notes for this episode for people to come and follow your work and to hopefully get hold of copies of Vessen or your other books. I would highly recommend them, both because they are visually very, very attractive to look at, but also because the actual research and the folklore is really interesting too. Johan, thank you so much for taking time out on your Sunday afternoon for joining us on the podcast, and I hope that you've covered everything that you would
like to talk
about.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
My thanks to Johan for joining me via the inevitable Zoom meeting to discuss his work. Do take a look online at some of his illustrations, as they are exquisite renderings of some of these folkloric creatures from Sweden. Do also email the podcast if you would like to suggest any themes for future episodes, or people that you would like to hear in interview, and we'll take up as much as possible in the coming months. Thanks for listening. Look after yourselves, and see you next time.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar-S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.